It's that time of the year again when your nice hosts take a few weeks off. The show will be back with new episodes 2 weeks from now. But until then, we have a few more favorites from 2024. This week's nice replay is episode 368. That's way too many pawns. Communicating difficulty, remixed play modes. Originally published October 11th, 2024. When we pick our nice replays, we try to balance out where in the year they come. And we try not to do too many from the end of the year.
Yeah.
Because people have heard them kind of recently.
Right.
But if it's a real good one,
you bring it in.
We want people to hear it again as soon as possible.
Yes.
And this is one that aired in October. And, you know, it's kind of a theme. My topic in here is remix play modes.
Yeah.
It's a theme that is a big, it matters to me a lot as a game designer. And you'll hear why in the episode. And it's something I circle around and I'll bring it up a lot. But it was nice to devote like a whole topic to it.
Yeah.
And give it some taxonomy.
Yeah.
And having the two of you help me like refine it.
Yeah. I appreciate that the way that the topic is written is not super clear exactly what it is, but like you listen to the episode, it makes sense.
To its credit, it's not super clear.
Yeah, it's more, you're like, oh, what is it? You know, it's a little bit.
On the other hand, Ellen's topic from this one, communicating difficulty, I think in true Ellen fashion, is like much easier to grok out of the box than true. Mine usually are.
Yeah, I mean, sometimes, and then sometimes we start, you know, sometimes like, I think Stephen and I do this sometimes, where we'll start with a topic and we'll be like, but what does it mean?
Yeah.
We want to start with like 10 minutes of that.
Yeah.
I think the game that sparked this one for me as a topic was Really Bad Chess, because I played a lot of that in 2024.
Yeah.
And anyway.
So just one more endorsement. You'll hear it in the episode as well, but from Ellen and myself, an endorsement of Really Bad Chess.
Yeah. So good.
So get ready for that. And the show will be back with new episodes in 2 weeks, starting with our annual What We Did on Our Winter Break episode. But while you wait, you can get this nice replay, all the nice replays, and all our other episodes ad-free, plus exclusive bonus audio that's pretty nice too, at patreon.com/nicegamesclub.
Also, Ellen's in the clubhouse.
Whoa, I'm here.
I don't think we mentioned that in the... listeners know that, you know, Ellen moved to Duluth.
I did.
Which, you know, I'm not a fan of Duluth personally, but... She's got a nice house. You got a nice house there. So.
You did come to visit.
I did.
Yeah.
Thank mostly you. To see you, not to see Duluth.
Yeah.
Well. But Ellen's here in the clubhouse today, which is great.
Kind of multi-purpose weekend. Mm-hmm. We got a show Eric and I are going to go see this evening. And we're house-sitting for my sister, and we're recording Nice Games Club.
Yeah.
Bam.
Cool.
Make a weekend out of it.
Yeah, exactly. It's also a beautiful fall day in the cities.
Yeah.
I don't know if I've spoken to a single human being who doesn't say fall if you don't like ask their favorite season. If they live in a place that has seasons, you're like, what's your favorite season? They're like pretty much always autumn.
Yeah.
I don't know. Is that true for you guys?
Well, you know, hold on to your horses because spring.
Yeah. I think I prefer spring.
Wow.
To fall. Well.
There's no impending dread.
Yes.
Which is a number one reason. Lots of rain.
Yeah.
Okay.
And like, you know. The sunshine after the rain.
Mm-hmm. But the mud, though.
I live in the city.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, that's fair.
Fair. All right. Yeah. Well, I've caught all the Pokemon now. I can be done with that game.
I guess it won't be recent news by the time this episode comes out, but we wouldn't talk about it. Anyways, Unity dropped the runtime fee thing that they were trying to retool again. I personally feel about the same as I did when we talked about it a year ago or whatever. When Unity was like, they walked a lot of it back.
Almost precisely a year ago.
Yeah.
Wow, interesting.
Yeah. Listeners can go back and listen to our emergency podcast that we recorded the day they detailed it and released that evening with Freya Holmer.
Yeah.
It was a doozy.
Yes.
A doozy of an episode and some doozy of a piece of news.
Right. I don't know. I guess I don't know what other people's, the vibe people were getting from response to the news, but most people, to me, felt like neutral on the news. There was no excitement or anything.
Yeah, it kind of came and went. And I think it's like you said, it might be old news. There might be a lot of listeners who are like, wait, what?
Yeah.
Because they stopped paying attention to it. Because the thing about the runtime fee was it was never going to hit a lot of people.
Mm-hmm.
The real big problem with it was just the communication problems and the concern of like, wait, is this retroactive? And what's going to happen next? Mm-hmm. And are you coming for who you're coming for next?
Right.
And all of that. And they really had to. I mean, they had, you know, crisis PR that week and that month and like barely got out of it alive.
Mm-hmm.
And then
then they had to start hyping Unity 6 this year. And I think it's likely that there's just a contingent of people who are like, well, because what ended up happening is the runtime fee would only apply to the next version of Unity, which is what they should have announced to begin with. Right. That was a big part of it. But
yeah,
that was a policy. It made some sense. It's like, here's a new version. Here's some new policies. Well, you know, it's up to them, right? You don't have to like it, but that's how it was. But it meant a lot of people were like, well, fine, I just won't update the Unity 6 then.
Right.
And then that's that. I think there was a big enough contingent of folks who were doing, who were saying that, whether they were serious about it or not, or would come around eventually. I think it was just enough in the air that, considering how few of those, that type of developer was ever going to be subject to the runtime fee, I think they just realized it wasn't worth the implementation.
Yeah.
My pet theory is that it really was about implementation, because the thing about it was it's a license fee. And when you're in a professional industry, like a B2B kind of industry, like let's say you're working with an engine you licensed for a PlayStation 2 game you're working on in 2003. There's no passwords or logins.
Yeah.
You call up the person in their accounting department and you give them your bank information.
Right.
Like, and they know you. Like, that's how that works. And so when it's time to report on your sales, it's a business relationship, like literally a relationship. And so that's why those things can be self-reported, because it's like the consequences of fraud in there are pretty enormous. When you have a mass market product like the Unity editor, you deal with lots of people who you don't know, who you have an email address just because they have your account, but have no relationship with them. And the when people saw the plan, they were like, wait, how are you going to know what's installed? Everyone was scared it was going to be like, you're not going to let me install spyware on my users' computers. Unity was never going to do that. And they were never planning to do that. But it really looked like they were, because it's the only thing that made sense to people.
Right.
Because they're used to signing up with Apple, paying Apple 30%. Like that kind of relationship is what developers these days, even people who've been working in the industry for a long time, that's how we expect these things to work. Especially if it's a company you don't have a relationship with, you're signing a contract for a license. And so, but Unity didn't appreciate that. It was a problem with the communication. So I think when they finally clarified it, people were like, okay, so I can just not tell you. Like, I think I don't think anyone was like planning for wide scale duplicity on that, but everyone was still confused. Like, how does that make sense? It didn't track for them still.
Yeah.
Because that's not how the world works anymore. At least not at the scale when you're trying to let people download it for free and just use it on a million games. And so I think a lot of it was them just being like, well, we really don't actually have the infrastructure to administer a self-reporting system like this in a way that is good, that people are going to understand, forget complying with, just understanding it. And so I think, and because so few people would be subject to it, I think that's why they weren't worried about it. But everyone has to deal with it hanging over them.
Yeah.
And no people, indie studios don't have accounting departments.
Right.
So like it's, no one's tracking this exactly.
Yeah.
Like they, you know, you go to your Steam account and you check to see your sales, or your reviews or things like that. You're not actually counting installs. You know, you're looking at the number, but you're going about your day. You're not actually, there's no admin to do after that. And so I think that the asking a lot of people to do that, they just didn't think it was, just didn't make any sense. So I think they were like, well, all right, let's just not bother. And so what they ended up doing instead, because, you know, they did need to raise revenues, which was why they did it in the first place. They're increasing the prices for Unity Pro and Unity Enterprise by a nominal amount. You know, it's not nothing, but it's also not nothing. But that kind of skated under the wire, because it seemed a good news to a lot of people who were just never paying for Unity anyway.
Yeah.
You know, but what was kind of nice about it was in advance of their Unite conference, which from where we're sitting was last week, where they had talked a lot more about Unity 6 and put a release date on it, which I wish I had in front of me. It's October 17, something like that. Pretty soon after this episode comes out. And with that, it's like, oh, well, now it's safe to update to Unity 6. Like, Unity had a culture change. It's up to everyone to decide whether they believe it, but like, they were always a corporation. It's like, there's only so much trust you can give any of them.
Yeah.
But I'm now interested in updating my projects to Unity 6 because it looked kind of good. And I'm particularly interested in the next, they did a little roadmap session where they talked about the next generation of Unity after Unity 6. They described how they're it's a whole thing. You can look it up. We'll put it in the show notes about how Unity is doing its, it, instead of yearly releases, they're with like tech releases and long-term. It was very confusing to a lot of people because you're like, don't upgrade until the release is ready. But then all the hype is around the new versions, but they say don't use it on a project. Mm-hmm. Now they're just going back to a more traditional, like, it's ready to go. You can use it on your project. When 6.1 comes out, you can use that on your project.
Okay.
And that's how they're doing it now. But the those releases will be spread out a little longer.
Yes.
For stability purposes.
Cool.
It's going to be a little simpler. But they talked about when that generation is through, they're going to make a ton of changes. They're going to be pulling out a lot of their tech debt. They're getting rid of the built-in renderer. They're doing a lot of stuff that like they've just been holding off doing. And there'll be a ton of breaking changes. So I believe few projects will be able to go from Unity 6 to the next version. There probably will be a migration guide,
mm-hmm.
And ways to do it. No doubt that will matter to them. But they're finally deciding for the following version, they're going to actually do a lot of, they're going to start fresh.
Yeah.
They're going to get rid of a lot of deprecated systems. They have a new way to mark systems as deprecated, which is a little bit clearer and a little more aggressive than they've been in the past, which is good because the problem with a lot of systems they replace is then they end up with three or four systems. And that's it in a noble goal. It's like you want to support all use cases, but then people don't know what to do.
Exactly. Right.
And then the old systems work, and then that gives them the permission to ship new systems that aren't quite finished, which is a rapid release idea, but users didn't respond well to it.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it all came from a positive thing. And looking back on it, we can now see it with rose-tinted glasses, but it was annoying while it was happening. It's like this new thing they're all excited about. They spent, hours on stage at various events talking about, but we can't use it for years because it's not really ready.
Yeah.
Like, they wanted to tell us about it, but like, it's just a weird, it was hard for people to react to it.
Right.
Anyway, so it feels like this is the first step in what it seems like it's going to be a much better Unity. Mm-hmm. Focused more on the engine, more on game development. They explicitly called themselves out saying like, we wanted to be the tool for all purposes. And we are not doing that anymore.
Mm.
So, like, that was good to just have them say that.
Yeah.
So, if you're like, I'm going to Godot and I'm never going back, good for you. Like, you do not owe them any more of your attention.
Right.
Like, if they lost you, you don't ever have to, But if you have a lot invested in the Unity ecosystem, I think there's a reason to get kind of excited about the Unity ecosystem again.
Yeah.
But see how it plays out.
That's mm-hmm. probably why they were sharing that roadmap, even though. It's a ways out.
Yeah.
It's about that transparency and, mm-hmm.
Well, also, it's going to be very disruptive when it does happen.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And so I think they're getting people ready for it.
Yeah, good point.
So I think you're right. I think hype is important. It's like people are like, okay, because Unity 6 is good. It's got the build profiles are what I'm excited about because I'm going to have a couple projects. I'm doing multi-platform. So having build profiles will be great.
Yeah.
Other than that, I'm not that excited about any particular new features in Unity 6, but I believe in upgrades. Things do get better and faster. It's generally true. So there's, I always like to have the latest. But I think it is not, for a lot of people, they're like, well, get me excited about something crazy, something wild. And I think that's what this next one, bit of the hype for that is, So we'll see.
Yeah.
Yeah. In other news, we've been playing games.
Okay.
That's good.
That was a real slick transition.
Yeah.
Mark,
you've been playing Astrobot?
Yeah, I picked up Astrobot. That's the PlayStation. It's the PlayStation Mario Galaxy is what it is.
As amazing as everybody's raving about?
It is very, very good. Okay. If you've played Astro's Playroom, which came free with every PS5, which is a joy, and an unabashed marketing tie-in. It's like PlayStation symbols all over the place.
Yeah.
But you're playing a PlayStation, so it's not like... It doesn't feel that icky because you already own the thing they're advertising
sure.
to, so it's no big deal.
I suppose that's
and true. It's a free game.
Mm.
This is the full version of the same thing. It's the same mechanics and a bigger, a bolder game. They charge full price for. Worth it. It's a great game.
Cool.
And the sort of it's charming. I don't have a lot of nostalgia for PlayStation.
Sure.
But like I love Ratchet and Clank. I recognize a lot of the characters that show up.
Mm-hmm.
They're like, oh, it's the intelligence cube. Like I played that at my friend's house. I remember that.
Good times.
Like, oh, they got the cat from Stray in there. Cool.
Mm-hmm.
So some third party stuff that is sort of notably associated with PlayStation.
Mm-hmm.
But they don't have the sort of Nintendo mascot roster, even though they have lots of characters. So it's sort of as part of it is like, okay, nice try, PlayStation. I mean, but it's charming. After a while, though, because it's a very long game, because all games are really long now.
Yeah.
after a while, it does start to feel very empty.
Oh.
Like empty calories as, okay. as a gameplay experience.
Yeah, okay.
Like I'm definitely someone that you've heard me on this show talk about, like, just the purpose of games as an art form. And it's something I really believe in as a developer. Mm-hmm. As a player, I'm happy to play those games, certainly. Mm-hmm. I'm an avid consumer of them, but I'm also love a classic platformer.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Like, and for its own reasons. There are separate reasons. But I think with this one, I was like, oh, it does just feel like empty calories after a time.
Mm-hmm.
I'm still enjoying it.
All right.
But I'm not as much with a Mario. And I wonder if that's just because Mario, even though it's, you know, every release in the last 20 years is full of nostalgia for itself.
Yeah.
So there's that as well. That's mm-hmm. more genuine, perhaps. So that's probably biasing me a little bit, but also it is its own universe.
Yeah.
And so even if it's just silly and not much is going on, it is its own creative space.
Yeah.
Whereas I think this game is a little bit too much of, like, generic environments that are very clever and well-made. And then the sort of joy you get out of it tends to be from the, like, the, oh, that's cool how they made those trees in the shape of the PlayStation icons, mm-hmm. you know,
mm-hmm.
Which is not quite the same as actually building a world of its own.
Sure. Yeah, that's fair.
I don't know. I have kind of mixed feelings, but yeah, it's starting to feel a little emptier than I'd hoped it would be.
Mm-hmm.
I suppose I shouldn't have been surprised.
Yeah, I suppose. I knew it wouldn't live up to the, because everybody was like, this is a perfect game. And I'm like, it definitely isn't a perfect. Anyway.
well,
but I always react to that game.
This is all on that. Top of the fact that it is, like, one of the best platformers I've ever played.
But, all right. We'll see. So, okay. We got back there.
Yeah. It's just, maybe that's just not enough anymore.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's fair. I've been playing Deadlock.
Mm-hmm.
It's the Steam game that I get, or not Steam, Valve. They're not just Steam. I guess.
Valve does things.
I guess. Anyways, I've been playing that, and I'm remembering how terrible I am at MOBAs. and I used to play League of Legends a lot. Like, League of Legends is the reason why I make video games. I'm really bad at this game. It doesn't help that it's a shooter, and I'm bad at shooters in general. But I just, you know, a bunch of my friends started playing it, and I was like, okay, I'll start playing it.
This is the one that they didn't announce.
It was the one that they didn't announce, and then, like, a few people on Twitch and whatever were streaming it.
Yeah.
But, like, not everybody was allowed to stream it for
some
reason.
I got a beta invite for it.
Oh, okay.
Like, 3 or 4 weeks ago.
Yeah.
And because I'd read about that, so I just assumed that more invites had gone out, or maybe someone invited me. I don't know how that system works.
Yeah, I don't know. A friend of mine invited me to it.
Yeah,
that's cool.
So that must have been what happened to me.
Yeah,
but I'm not really a Steam user, so like I wasn't really interrogating what was going on. I was just like, oh, isn't that game they didn't announce?
Mm-hmm.
Like,
yeah, it's cool. It's weird. Yeah.
I mean, I think it's just evidence that Valve has a monopoly in like, what other company could do that?
Right.
I know. Exactly.
Like, it's actually very concerning.
It is concerning also.
It's true.
Yeah.
I mean, that being said, though, the game's fun.
Yeah.
That's good.
But yeah, I mean, it's got all of the Valve baggage that comes along with it.
Oh yeah.
Wait, do you mean, like, mechanically?
No, not mechanically.
You just mean businessy stuff.
Businessy stuff.
Oh, okay.
Mechanically, I honestly,
I don't know what a Valve game even is.
I don't
is
either.
Anymore,
like, I just know Portal and Portal 2.
Yeah.
So,
and nobody who works on Portal still works at Valve, as far as I know.
Yeah. Yeah.
Or,
so,
you know, it's, as a company, it doesn't really have a house style any longer, right?
Yeah, I don't. As far as I know, it doesn't.
Yeah.
I don't know what that means, but yeah. At any rate, it's enjoyable,
mm-hmm.
and maybe if you're better at MOBAs than me, you can beat me in the game one day.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's the game I've been playing. Ellen, I see you have been playing Switch Monopoly.
Yeah, I've been playing a couple things. So, my nephew, his birthday was yesterday,
mm-hmm.
And one of the gifts that he got, it was not the gift that I gave him. I gave him some drawing books that he already had, which sucks. So I have to figure that out.
Oh, no.
Kid loves to draw. He loves to draw. So I was like, okay, we'll give him some books to help him draw Pokemon. He already had that. He gave him some books to draw sea creatures. He already had that. So I got to find maybe Godzilla. Anyway, like that. Right. But one of the gifts that he did get was another couple games for the Switch. And one of the ones he wanted to spin up yesterday when I was visiting was this kind of had three, you know, tabletop games, but on Switch. So one was Trivial Pursuit, one was Risk, and one was Monopoly. And he wanted to try them all. So we tried them all.
Okay.
We tried Risk. Pretty good adaptation for a game that always lasts way too long.
Yeah.
And Trivial Pursuit, he doesn't like quiz games, so we didn't really get that far. Also, we didn't get that far in that one.
Sure.
And we tried Monopoly, and it was I mean, it's just an interesting choice in general to adapt Monopoly, I think, to like, it's a game that you're supposed to walk, everyone except for one person is supposed to walk away feeling defeated and disappointed is how I feel Monopoly was designed. But like, yeah, it was some interesting choices. But so that's been fun. It just, I like hanging out with people playing games.
Yeah.
So I've been, you know, enjoyed that a little bit. I've been watching Eric play the new Final Fantasy, and that's been fun.
Oh, right. 16 came out on PC.
Yeah. Yeah.
Forgot about that.
Yep.
Yeah.
That's the MMO?
No. 14 is the MMO. Okay. 16 is the one with the emo looking protagonist.
That one.
You know, there's the boy band one?
That's 15.
That's 15. It's right. The one after that one.
The one after.
I missed that. It came out after that?
It came on PS5 exclusively, and I think that might have been why. Yeah. Okay. I watched.
Wait, is it one of the like the fantasy ones or one of the techno fantasy ones?
It's more fantasy than techno.
That's probably why I didn't pay any attention to it.
Yeah. That makes sense. I did watch somebody play it, and it is extremely flashy.
Yeah. It looks pretty.
Yeah.
It's a very pretty game, which he has running on his very pretty computer and a very pretty desktop. So I just like park in the office. Anyway, so that's been fun. And then I've also been playing the games from the series. We Were Here. Ah. So it's a series of two-player puzzle, you know, cooperative puzzle games. And we've been working our way through them and screaming a lot.
Because the puzzles are hard.
The puzzles are hard. And also just like we're both easily, I think we're very emotionally reactive players. Ah. And which makes us react harder to each other. And so it's like, oh, there's lava coming up through the floor. Oh, my God, there's lava coming up through the floor. So it's a lot of fun to play with her. So that's pretty cool.
That's nice.
The other thing I want to mention in the meta here is actually not a game.
Okay.
It's a tool. And it's a tool for studying feedback loops, which I thought might be really interesting for everybody. And it's called Loopy. So you can like quickly like spin up. It's almost like a diagramming tool, like a mind mapping tool.
Mm-hmm.
In the way that it's like put together. It's an online tool. It's web-based. And it's quick to build, you know, your diagrams and so on and so forth. But what you'd end up doing is for each of your nodes on your diagram, you have like an up arrow and a down arrow. And then you can like map it to another node and map the relationship like increases or decreases to the other node. So, and then you can anywhere on the map, you can press up and then you'll see all these little up arrows and down arrows, almost like Reddit upvotes and downvotes, but they're like cascading across the screen and these up arrows and down arrows. And so it lets you like speed it up and slow it down, and so you can kind of see like where the motion of a system is. And I thought that'd be really cool. So we'll link to that in the show notes.
Cool. Yeah. That's
and neat. This is just for mapping arbitrary systems.
Yeah.
It's not particular to anything.
Not particular to any type of system.
Mm-hmm.
It's a way to quickly map out and explore system dynamics, any sort of systems.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Neat. I'll have to check that out.
Yeah. It's pretty cool. And it's got a cool name. Loopy is a cool name.
Yes. Cool. Okay. Shall we get started on the next topic?
Sure.
The first topic, not the next one.
I guess it's the next one and the first official one, which is...
Good transition.
Yes. The next topic, the first... Well, I'm sure we'll make a better transition to Mark's topic. Okay, so I wanted to talk about difficulty, which is probably why it was so hard to transition into this topic. And we were kind of talking a little bit about what angles we wanted to take into this topic before we started recording. And I think that the first thing is it's an Ellen topic. So you know what that means. We're going to start big and we're going to get specific, or we're going to start specific and get big, and then we'll have a better understanding of what the word means by the end. Yeah. That's the goal.
Yep.
The reason I started thinking about difficulty was because I've been playing a game that gives you a lot of kind of granular control over the fairly simple gameplay.
Mm.
Well, it's not maybe necessarily simple gameplay, but like the game is fairly easy to learn, and then there's a lot of depth to it. And that game is Really Bad Chess. So I'm not a great chess player. That's why I really like Really Bad Chess, because it's not regular chess. You have different numbers of pieces. You might have you might be playing with four queens, which is awesome. You might be playing with six bishops, which sucks. But this game, it's by Zach Gage. And Mark, you play it a lot, too.
Yes, I play it as part of Puzmo, which I've talked about on the show before.
Yeah.
It's like sort of a daily newspaper games kind of vibe. And there's two really bad chess games you can play every day.
Yeah.
But it's a long stand. It's been around a long time. It has been. You're playing the original app version.
Yeah, I'm playing the original app version. And I've had it on my system for a long time. But it's always been something that I kind of just popped into, played a game or two, and then forgot about for a while. But I've been playing it on a more regular basis lately, and kind of playing the ranked mode. And so there are different modes in the game, which might come up later in this topic. But one of the really, I think, cool features is this kind of free play mode, where you can manually change your ranking. So from the way that I've been kind of looking at it, you know, the higher rank you get, the more difficult the play is, right? Yeah. So your board configuration as compared to your opponent's is weaker. So you might be playing with six bishops and your opponent might be playing with four queens, and you've got six bishops and four knights and that's it. I don't know. That's not it. You know, there are more pieces that you have right, than that when you start 12, out.
But yeah.
Right. But like, yeah. Obviously more queens is easier.
Yeah. Wait, 14 pieces? I forget how many pieces are on each side of chess. I don't play chess a lot. I'm bad at it too. Anyway, sorry.
Well, see, like, I'm trying to think of the normal number of different pieces and I'm like, wait a second. How many bishops are you supposed to have? It's not six.
Yeah.
It's just two.
Yeah. At any rate.
Yeah.
Yeah. When you play it long enough, you just think it's chess.
Yeah.
But it's super not. Yeah. Yeah. Right. Normal chess, you have the two rooks, the two knights, the two bishops, and then the king and the queen. So it's, what, 10 pieces?
I've known the answer to this since this conversation started. I'm just waiting for the two of you to get there.
12 pieces.
Listeners, you tell us, because I'm not going to look it up and I don't want to do the math.
No, it's 14 pieces.
I don't remember.
It's 16 pieces.
It's 16? Oh, I wasn't even close. Okay.
It's way too many pawns. Who wants that many pawns? Ugh. Yeah, anyway.
Nobody wants that many pawns. Nobody wants that many pawns. But in real bad chess, you usually have way fewer pawns.
We usually have way fewer pawns and more of other things. Anyway, but so in ranked mode, you have a sliding scale and you can kind of, you can use it for practice, right?
Yeah.
But you can like start it really low and so you have a better board. You can go really high. We have a harder board and you can like sit there. Right now, I'm kind of sitting at rank 35 because I think my ranked mode, I'm at like rank 40 and I honestly don't know if that's good or not. Mm-hmm. It feels good.
Okay.
It's a number.
Yeah.
And so I've just been practicing over and over at rank 35 in this ranked difficulty mode.
Yeah.
But what's really interesting is like just observing how when you change the slider on the difficulty or on the ranked mode, how it changes your board configuration. And that got me thinking, okay, what are some other ways, you know, how is this system put together behind the scenes? That's an interesting thing to think about. But then also, like, how does that relate to other difficulty scaling systems? I think one that comes up, you know, that kind of comes to mind really frequently is the way that RPGs go, right? Like, okay, you progress in the game and your stats get better, but the stats of the enemies get harder. And then you can start the game at a harder mode, which means, like, the ratio of difference between those things, the delta there is greater to start with, potentially.
Yeah.
And so I wanted to kind of start with that because I wanted to think about like different ways that game designers can give players more control over the difficulty. But the other thing I wanted to talk about was how you communicate expectations around difficulty to players before they actually start playing. Because, you know, looking at really like this, the name Really Bad Chess, I think is a brilliant way of communicating the flexibility and the difficulty. Because, like, chess comes with a lot of connotations.
Right.
The word chess, like, lots of people are familiar with it. Even if they don't know the words of the game, they have it, or the rules of the game. Even if they don't know the rules of the game, they have some feelings about it or some knowledge about it, and they're bringing that to the game. But if you say really bad chess, you're trying to capture some of that familiarity, but then also make it more approachable. And so I thought that was a really interesting way of communicating that kind of approach to difficulty to the player in a really elegant way. And so I also wanted to talk about that, just like how you can communicate that, your approach to designing the difficulty of a game to players when they're considering whether they want to pick your game up.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Well, when you bring that up, it makes me think of another Crab's Treasure, which is a Dark Souls-like game.
Mm-hmm.
But it's got cute characters and fun and like colorful art and things like that makes it look very not the game that it's trying to be like.
Mm-hmm.
And I found that game to be interesting because I think a lot of people approached this game because Dark Souls has also not as strong a connotation as chess because chess is much older. But Dark Souls has a strong connotation in that, you know, people associate it with very difficult and grindy in that, like, you have to keep bumping your head into a wall until you get past the wall, right? Another Crab's Treasure does the same thing, but because it's cute, I think a lot of people approached it who normally would not have. Mm-hmm. Additionally, that game allows the crab to have a gun, so not quite the same as Dark Souls. But I think that, like, it just allowed the way that it communicated its difficulty is it almost, like, obscures that concept of it. Hmm. Just due to the fact that it's cuter, I think. A lot of people felt like they could approach it more, or at least look at it, that they maybe wouldn't have if it was, like, Dark Souls aesthetic.
Yeah, has there been any... I mean, is the audience for that game people who come in looking for a Dark Souls that's cute? Mm. Or a cute game, wait, this is Dark Souls?
I think it's a combo of the two.
Yeah.
From what I have observed, I've noticed that, like, well, I will sometimes watch people who play games that are like Dark Souls, because Dark Souls is too scary for me, even though I like the idea of those games. And people will come in and be like, you should play another Crab's Treasure because it's another Dark Souls. And so, like, I think people do, you know, they will seek out that Dark Souls gameplay and go to this game for that reason. But I also think that people who were kind of interested in Dark Souls but maybe didn't like the aesthetics or the community around Dark Souls felt like they could approach this game due to the fact that it doesn't have all of that baggage.
Yeah. Well, it's that studio made another crab-themed game prior, right?
Am
I mixing them up with someone else?
I don't remember. The studio's name, I believe, is AgroCrab?
Yeah.
Because
they had made something that was a little cuter and more approachable, I thought. Mm-hmm.
Oh, they made Going Under.
Yeah.
That you're talking about? Yeah.
Right. Not crab theme. Just this company is.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's was a little less punishing.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's a roguelike.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I wonder how much of the, I guess, because I've heard that before, like games that have that that there's a sort of irony to the theming to how the gameplay works. And that works on some people, and then it really doesn't work on other people.
Absolutely.
You know?
That's true. Well, that's the thing, right? Is like, because you're communicating a certain idea, it's like if you went into a game and expected Animal Crossing, and then you got Dark Souls, like, you'd be upset, I would think.
You'd have a reaction.
You might be thrilled, I suppose.
But there's some unexpected surprise to it, yes. Which makes Really Bad Chess as a name, sort of described it, lets you know, it sort of takes the heat off of chess.
Yeah.
Right.
But what I like about it is that I look at that, I can have a couple reactions to it. Either Really Bad Chess is like, oh, this is broken, and that's enjoyable about it, or it's a parody game, or it's not something to be taken seriously. That's generally the vibe you get.
Yeah.
But it doesn't really say anything about the difficulty, but it prepares you really well for what it is, which is that it's heavily weighted towards the player by default. Mm-hmm. And so you can't, so that casual impression that it gives is accurate, but maybe not in the way you thought it was. And it's sort of interesting. This reminds me of the episode we did on branding about how, like, you don't actually have to explain to your players what it is. You just have to set some expectations so that when they find out what it is, it makes sense to them.
Yes.
Yeah.
And that sounds like that's the case there.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a really good way of phrasing it, I think. Right. You don't have to tell people what it is before they pick it up, because they're going to discover that through playing it. And they should, because that's why people do things. To experience them. But you do need to set expectations in a way that leaves people open to the type of experience you are going to provide.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So I'm just thinking of, you know, various titles that have gotten a reputation for difficulty. Like, I've never played Cuphead. I hear that it's tough. I don't know. Okay. That one looks cute.
Yeah. That's one where I think a lot of people played it because of the art style.
Right.
And then they suffered through it because it's a kind of difficult game.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But they liked it enough that they, even though it wouldn't have been a game they'd have played otherwise.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Because that game is, like, brutally difficult.
Yes.
It gives no impression that's what it's going to be.
Yeah. Right. Yeah.
And then you start playing and it's obvious.
Yeah.
But it never makes sense.
Yeah. Yeah. That's pretty accurate how the game works.
Yeah.
Maybe an example of one of those like ironic dissonances between the art style and the end playing experience. But yeah, it's interesting. There isn't a ton of modularity, I guess, or control for the player on the difficulty in the in those types of games that we're describing, right? Mm-hmm. Like, you know, Dark Souls, you can probably you can eventually work towards a build that is maybe going to make the game easier, mm-hmm. but you still have to like go through the difficulty of running around without much gear and learning how to fight, or get really lucky like I did and kick the boss off the roof. Eric had me play Dark Souls for my 30th birthday, and I think the bet was like, you know, you just have to just work your way towards the first past the first boss, and then we'll call it good. And I beat the boss by kicking him off, like kicking it off the roof. And I was like, all right, I've beat. That's good enough. I'm good at Dark Souls now. Thank you. He was so mad. I love bringing that up.
I mean, that's an awful birthday gift, so serves him right.
Yeah.
Well, I think I agreed to it. But yeah, he also got me a really nice bottle of scotch that year. Oh, okay. So it was definitely felt fair. Yeah.
He figured you'd go through it the whole time, and you just...
Yeah.
Instead,
yeah. You did I definitely think he thought it would take me a lot longer than it did.
That's funny.
Anyway.
I wanted to bring up, cause this makes me think of like multiplayer games, that like those can't, well, they can be, the player can't control for the difficulty in a competitive game, right? Because like you're going against somebody who is maybe better than you or maybe worse than you, and you can't really control that.
Mm-hmm.
In online settings, when you know, you're matched up with somebody else, a lot of games will use skill-based matchmaking to determine, how likely you are to beat this other player or team. Mm-hmm. And one thing I've recognized is that like gamers feel particularly upset about how skill-based matchmaking works, because I think it like oftentimes games are trying to balance it so that you win 50% of the time.
Mm-hmm. Nobody wants that.
Nobody wants that. Right. They want to win 70% of the time. Exactly. 80% of the time.
Yep. They want to be subsidized. They want their wins subsidized by an unseen class of players who lose most of the time.
Exactly.
The invisible hand of matchmaking.
Right. Yeah. And so I think that like
they want to be capitalists. And the game designers are like, no. to each according to their ability.
Yeah. Oh good, that's great. But I think that's an interesting wrinkle in this conversation, because like I think that oftentimes people will see skill-based matchmaking and I think players will see that and be like, oh, this game sucks now because like I can't control how likely I am I'm going to win. Or they think they're better they think they're better at the game than they actually are.
Mm-hmm.
And so they keep blaming this matchmaking system over what they're like, how good they're actually doing.
Mm-hmm.
And so like I think that actually a lot of this stuff is kind of like baggage around certain ideas of games, or things, and not even necessarily just the game itself.
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of interesting. I'm recognizing now, because like even just this term is already turning people away from a game.
Yeah,
in a way that like it feels like it shouldn't.
Well, you know, that's interesting. Actually, now that you're describing it in that way, it actually reminds me of an episode. I think it was of the podcast Freakonomics, and they're talking about, I think, the optimal amount of failure in like a learning context.
Yeah.
And basically they're like, according to the way like research that looks into this, the optimal amount of failure to maximize your learning is 20%.
Mm.
So basically like if you're at a B-, that means you are optimizing for like your progression of learning.
Interesting.
Essentially, which is not what people think. That's not what people want.
Right.
Like if I got a B- in my house when I was growing up, there was a problem.
Mm-hmm.
Until I got to calculus and then everyone gave up. that was a different episode. We talked about it earlier. But you know, you don't want to pay for a game that's going to make you feel B-.
Yeah.
You want to pay for a game and you want it to make you feel A, even though like if you're looking at the global player base of any game, whether it's multiplayer or not, most players are going to be average. You can't all have a B- even. So it is really an interesting challenge. And I think you've really nailed it there, is that difficulty is a feature or a dynamic or some sort of system you have to think about in your gameplay, but it's in service of the emotional experience you're going for.
Yeah.
And you have to, even though most of your players are going to be average, you want them all to feel awesome, or at least awesome enough to keep playing.
Well, I mean, that's not always, that's not technically required.
Okay.
Yeah.
That is, I think the state of play in games.
Ah.
But I don't think that's fundamental. I don't think that's necessarily the lesson.
Okay.
Because I mean, you have a goal. You want players to feel something,
right?
But what you want them to feel is up to you.
Yeah. Right. Fair enough.
And you know that, like, there's a difference in like multiplayer and single player between like losing and failing.
Yeah.
And the amount of losing that you can tolerate is different from the amount of failure you can tolerate. Sure. I think.
Mm, good point.
At least by that definition.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, I think it's, I guess the idea is just be more mindful of like of the success of that getting through, not whether like, oh, we've tested players and they fail, they get roughly a B minus on average as they go through these levels. That's about what we were aiming for, so we're good. And it's like, that's actually not the evaluation necessarily.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Yeah, I don't think there's a formula that's going to work across the board, but I like the language that we've used in points through this conversation, because I think that kind of clarifies or makes it easier to clarify what a given game's goals are, right? And I think if you have obviously, if you have a greater sense of clarity about what your own game is supposed to be, then you are going to have an easier time communicating it to potential players.
Yeah.
And so I guess that's what I've learned through this conversation is difficulty is something you want to think about. There's an emotional aspect to it.
Yeah.
Think about it in terms of how, you know, what you want your players to feel as they're playing your game. And then think about how you're going to communicate that to people who haven't played it yet.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Glom is a game. Glom is a game that we made.
You know, and it does it enough times, and it's like a half-hearted delivery.
Yeah.
We don't get the classic Ellen.
Get the full. Glom. All right.
Thank you. Proceed.
Okay. Thank you. Okay. Glom is a game that we made. We've mentioned it before. It is a tabletop game that you play with your friends, and you basically romp around with words. It's called, we created this tagline, it is a romp of rewording regular remarks. And we made it, we actually started making it on a Nice Games Jam episode, which was a lot of fun. You can play it in 5 minutes, or you can take 50 minutes to play if you want to keep playing it round after round. It's really hard to stop at one round, but it is an easy game to pick up. If you like wordplay and you have friends who like wordplay, you're going to have a blast. You can learn more at nicegames.club/glom.
Okay, so my topic, I had some trouble coming with a title for this, which is kind of a good sign for our topics. Ellen's was similar. We had to workshop it a little bit until you figured it out. And that usually means it's going to be interesting and open-ended.
Yeah.
So I hope maybe let's see if this one can live up to that one. But remix play modes. So the idea is that we have talked on the show a lot in the past about ways people play games and ways people play the same games.
Yeah.
And so that includes things like going for all the collectibles, 100%ing something, or going through the achievements, like a new game plus or some alternate way to play the game.
Right.
And so we've done all that, but I want to talk a little bit about sort of what makes that possible and ways to define it explicitly or implicitly.
Okay.
So I want to talk about the vocabulary of a game's design.
Okay.
I don't know if that's the right way to say it, but that's kind of the phrase that I've been using when we've been talking about Robustin lately.
Yeah.
Is the idea of like, what are the parts of the game? Those are the words. It's the vocabulary of the mechanics. And then what can you do with all those words to make gameplay? Because a lot of times when we are thinking of like ways to make wouldn't it be interesting if you do this or that? I always want to think, well, what can we do with the pieces we have to make that, right, instead of adding a new piece? So that's been kind of where my head's at with that. And so I want to sort of examine games that we have played that maybe do that or don't and are successful at not doing it.
Yeah.
I don't know. But let's walk. I got an outline here. Let's walk through it.
Okay.
So the idea is just that you can build a different game within the game.
Right.
Right. Composed of parts of original games. So like sandbox games, this is sort of like an emergent gameplay feature of those games. There is no game. All you have is parts of games, right?
Yeah.
So, I mean, that's not totally true. There's usually some sort of adventure mode or something, but like Minecraft or Roblox has a market of different game types. So that's very explicitly parts of a, you know, so there's varying degrees of this.
Yeah.
There's, I think, the difference between making it explicit versus implicit. So, got some examples for each, and then I want to talk a little bit about those differences and some examples, some more examples from you guys.
Yeah.
So like an explicit way would be like in Zelda, in like the latest Zelda games, when you go into one of the combat shrines where you lose all your gear and you're and you're just now having to start from scratch.
This is an explicit version, you said?
Yes. It explicitly remixes the game and makes you play it in a different way.
Okay.
Even though it's not really, it's still the same game with all the same parts.
Yeah.
But like now it's a different mode, essentially. Mm. And it's just remixed from what you've got. It's a pretty simple way to do it, but it is a pretty, I generally did not like those modes.
Okay.
Because one of the satisfying feelings of that game is composing your build, the things you have, the which pieces, which armor bonuses you're getting.
Right.
And your in your collection of impossible to manage inventory.
Yeah.
And when all that's gone, it's actually quite fun. It becomes more of a puzzle because enemies are relatively easy to tackle, and then some are surprisingly difficult.
Yeah.
And then some are just positioned in a weird way. So it's very puzzly, which is right up my alley.
Yeah.
But like I didn't love that game because it was such a departure.
Sure. And well, the Breath of the Wild did it the one time, and then Tears of the Kingdom did it like seven times.
A ton of times.
Yeah, it was.
I would like cross my fingers when I answered, like, I hope it's not one of these. I hope it's not one of these. But it's kind of strange because on its own, and by the time I would get to the end of it, I would start enjoying it a little bit because I would get sort of used to it.
Mm-mm.
But anyway, that's what I mean by that's an explicit remix.
Yeah.
And then what that means is that you're communicating that to the player and then they have the reaction the way I did. So another one that people generally hate that I loved is Mario Sunshine's floodless levels. So they were like bonus levels that were like just pure platforming. You didn't have flood, so it was just the platforming mechanics.
Yeah.
And because Sunshine is like a technical mess, lots of bugs, and the people hated it for that reason.
Uh-huh.
But they also hated it for the same reason I had difficult or didn't enjoy the combat shrines.
Yeah.
Is they were just like a weird departure for no reason.
Yeah.
And I liked it because I did not like Mario Sunshine.
Right.
So I was excited about a weird departure. And of course, those levels became the basis for what Mario Galaxy. How Mario Galaxy played. So there's that as well. Mm-hmm. So that's, again, it's to taste, right? It's all, none of this is objective.
Yeah.
Some games have like one HP modes where you just can't get hit at all.
Right.
Or like modes that will limit equipment, like full playthroughs that'll just change the rules, remix some things. New Game Plus is this.
Right.
So it's not just things that make the game harder or more restrictive, although I think that's probably the most common way these modes are generally done. But New Game Plus is exactly this as well. You get more stuff.
Yeah.
You play the game again. It's the same game. It's just things are just different, balanced differently or composed differently.
Yeah.
That's explicit, right? Implicit is where the game provides the environment for you to play it in a different way on your own.
Okay.
And so the best example I could think of this is the only one I really have is, I know there are more, so I want to ask you guys, but pacifist runs.
Oh, yeah.
Lots of games have these. So Metal Gear Solid designs for them.
Hmm.
Undertale famously has that. And a million other ways to play an Undertale. So that's also a good example for that reason. But some games, you can just do this on your own. It can be emergent gameplay rather than designed for. But I am thinking about the sort of implicit ones that are designed for.
Specifically designed for.
Okay. Yeah, but not necessarily a mode you select in a menu.
Yeah.
Or a level you encounter in the middle. Is there anything like that you guys can think of?
Right. So you're not, when you're talking about implicit modes, you're not talking about like speed running.
I sort of am.
Okay. All right.
Because you don't select that from the main menu.
No, you do not.
You're going for a different goal.
Yeah.
Right?
You're layering on additional goals beyond the goal of just beating the game or something like that.
So in that same vein, a lot of games have speed running modes.
That is true. Yeah.
And
well, that's kind of what ties these things together, right?
Yeah.
Is it, whether it's implicit or explicit, is sort of here nor there. It can be or it doesn't have to be.
Yeah.
But yeah, right? This is the kind of thing that can be one or the other.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, because I was having a hard time understanding the difference between explicit and implicit as well. But I guess the fact that you don't... Because, like you said, like certain examples have... certain examples of implicit ones have, like... They're designed in a way so that, like, they support this thing, but they don't... I guess explicitly, there it is. They don't explicitly tell you. Yeah. They don't explicitly tell you this is how you have to play now.
Yeah.
So I guess that's the difference is like the game is not expressly telling you have to play this way. It's not forcing you to do it.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Interesting.
Yeah. I mean, I guess speedrunning was the first thing that came to mind. The other thing that came to mind was, you know, like, just self-imposed gear restrictions. You mentioned like one HP mode under the explicit listing, but you know, basically any any like RPG style thing, and you just, right. just like, all right, try to beat it without this stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We were just talking about Dark Souls again in the difficulty, you know, on the top of the show, the first topic, but you know, just doing a total, like completely naked, no armor run.
Mm-hmm.
You've got like one starter weapon and your wits and your dodge and that's it.
Yeah.
I mean, mm-hmm. that's another example.
Yeah. I think this is where I may want to say, let's call it three categories then.
Okay.
Explicit, which is, yeah, it's in a menu or it's whatever. Mm. There's implicit where it's like the designers have created the path for you. And then there's emergent, okay. which is that it's possible.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. Right.
Yeah. It's, yeah. It's where, you know, so like implicit would be more like, you get an A+ at the end of the level if you don't take a hit.
Yeah.
But it doesn't mean anything.
Right.
Right. That's an implicit remix. Like it lets you decide to go for that because there's some way that it supports it officially without sort of imposing it upon you.
Right.
Emergent would be you get together with your friends and see who can get through the level without getting hit.
Yeah.
Right. And so the difference often, sometimes there's very little difference, but when there is a difference, it tends to be an implicit way would be where the developer is essentially expecting you to behave this way and then accommodates it
mm-hmm.
or provides the challenge for it. Like, and that can be really satisfying if the work is put in.
Yeah.
Emergent can be more fun because it's more user story. It's more like you invented a thing at home on your couch.
Right.
And that's really satisfying for its own reasons. So there's lots of things you'll get from all three of these types, I suppose.
Yeah.
Hmm.
But well, I think as you're talking about like speedrunning and those self-imposed restrictions, I was realizing, oh yeah, that's actually a much bigger category of this than I was assuming.
Yeah, well, I mean, in the same vein, when I was younger and playing Super Mario Sunshine, which I really like, opposed to Mark, I guess.
we'll table this fight for later.
Yeah, I would create like little courses, and I tried to get my brother to do it, but I don't think he liked the game as much as me. So I would make little courses for myself, and I would race to see how quickly I could go through the courses because I just really liked the movement in that game. So that is an example of emergent, right, that you're talking about?
Yeah.
And that, like, the game definitely doesn't support that. It's not like it had a little timer running whenever I started doing it, but I had my own little timer.
And it provides you with the rewards that playing games provides.
Yeah.
But no one's going to know.
Well, yeah, ultimately, I made...
It's not any worse.
Yeah. I made my own game within the game.
Mm-hmm.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
Hmm.
Yeah.
So this is where it's... like this implicit style where it takes what people bring to games and accommodates it or encourages it in a way that has the designer's hand but still allows for player freedom.
Yeah.
That's the thing that I'm obsessed with my own game design.
Mm-hmm.
Like it's a big part of Metro Nexus. And Steven, you talked about your own goals in that game.
Yeah.
Because the game, you know, it's not available, so I always have to try to summarize it when we talk about it.
Yeah.
But it's a single screen platformer battle game where at the end you are given the stats of what happened, and then players are kind of left to decide who the winner was.
Yeah.
They can look at the biggest number in this column or the highest graph in that column. The game itself has no opinion, so that was always a big part of that.
Mm-hmm.
And then watching players play and decide what they care about, and also the sort of social contract where they would have to agree on what's important.
Yeah.
And also the enjoyment of them disagreeing.
Yeah.
So that's the sort of the first time I really got to play with that notion of, and it came a lot of about my frustration with leaderboards and rankings and how I have a lot of problems with that. But you could still provide all that stuff in a way that was different. And then we all worked on Widget Satchel together and we've talked about how the core of that game is it's incredibly easy if you're bad at it.
Yeah.
The better you get at it, the more effort you put into it, the more challenge it becomes.
Mm.
And so you just decide where you want to be on that scale.
Yeah.
And that's all implicitly part of the gameplay. You don't have to engage with it at all if you don't want to.
Right.
Yeah.
GLOM even has this, right? So GLOM's scoring system is objective. It's one of our favorite things about GLOM.
Yes.
As a word game, it's not nonsense and who's the most popular. It's who got them points.
Yeah, yeah.
But the game does not care if you win. Like the amount of fun you have, I mean, unless you're that type of person, it doesn't have to be, like, you can still have the funniest phrase.
Yeah.
And everyone in your group can agree that one was the best.
Yeah.
And you can lose.
Right.
And GLOM is such that that's fine. That's a perfectly cromulent outcome.
Yeah.
And so it's the scoring is just a mechanic. It's not really a goal unto itself. It's certainly out of the box, it's what it looks like, and you can treat it that way. But that's sort of, that's valuable to why I think GLOM is interesting and also not cutthroat competitive,
yeah.
even though it has objective scoring. It's not, people don't, like, there's, we have the rules in the rule book. It says like, hey, don't try to be, a bad sport and just try to like cheat the system.
Yeah.
We never really saw people even try that. Like try to like exploit the rules to get high scores. They always preferred to go for the clever or funny phrases. And that's part of that is that the game lets you do that.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't impose the win conditions. It just gives you the system and you can do what you like with it.
Yeah.
And then the projects I'm working on now, I won't get into detail, but I'll talk a lot about when they're out.
Mm.
Both of them are, have a lot of that that I've brought to it. And,
sure.
And I've been really excited about that.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
That's kind of what I want to talk about this because I feel like it's, this isn't, lots of games have this.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I don't think necessarily the fact that I really like doing this in my design, I don't think I'm breaking a new ground here exactly. It's just my focus on it. I think it might be something a lot of people don't do, but I want to talk more about games that have that and whether it's something people recognize in games they play or we just don't have the language for that necessarily.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you definitely bring up a good point in looking at your game dev library.
Mm-hmm.
You definitely can see that pattern and that like a lot of the games don't explicitly say that this is the victory condition. They give you the tools to make your own victory conditions.
Yeah.
Robustin does this too, sort of. I mean, there are victory conditions, but there are a set of them.
Yeah, that's right. And I want to talk a little bit about that because we've all been actively working on that.
Mm-hmm,
and that comes from all of us.
Yeah.
And whatever influence my obsession with this had on it, I'm sure was there.
Mm.
But it wasn't me that alone that brought that to it.
That's true.
All right. So when you were talking about that, a couple things did spring to mind, and I actually feel like maybe I'm solidifying a thought.
Okay.
Oh boy.
I mean, really excited about this.
Oh, I really hope I'm not overselling it. So the way you were talking about it actually reminded me of how I hear people talk about Skyrim all the time.
Oh, yeah. Interesting.
It's like, oh yeah, we're gonna play this game, and then they play the game for hundreds of hours.
Yeah.
And like never do that, and like never
right.
beat it.
Yeah.
You know, like so there, it's like the win condition is there. There is a win condition, but it's not actually that important for enjoying the game.
Right.
And I wonder if it's that dynamic that is the core of what you're talking about, Mark.
Oh, okay. So what's interesting about that in particular is that that's the thing that I think I worry about because that's sandboxy, that's emergent, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the game is fun, so who cares if you win? That's great. I love that.
Yeah.
And there are games I play that are like that. But I think as a designer, I want to direct the player a little more than that.
Yeah.
Okay.
So there's kind of this like, it's this like all the games that I worked on that I described, they do it in a totally different way.
Yes.
Yeah.
And so there's no like one way to accomplish this. Right. It's just an event, which is why, like Steven, you say you can sort of recognize it in sort of my bibliography.
Yeah.
I don't know that you can.
Oh, okay.
I'd like to believe that one day people will look back on the games I made and recognize that.
Yeah.
But I wouldn't be surprised if they don't.
Mm.
Because it's expressed differently each time. And a game like Skyrim, where you can just noodle around forever, or even games that have tons of like open world games have tons of side quests that you just enjoy spending more time in. That is sort of implicit. Like, don't beat the game.
Yeah.
But I kind of that feels a little bit too open ended, too sandboxy for me.
Well, let me offer one more example then.
Yeah.
Because I think I've had an experience as a player doing something like this where I didn't necessarily expect to, and that was playing that National Parks game that I mentioned that I played with my parents.
Yeah, yeah.
Right. So we're all three of us very involved with nature, and I bought this game specifically because the art looked amazing, and I like parks, and I also think the national parks are amazing, and you know you should visit them and make sure that the National Park Service is funded and all that. Okay, which you can do by buying the game, by the way.
Ah,
some of their purchase price I think goes to supporting stuff. Anyway,
cool.
We played the game over two sessions. Let's split it in half. And every time we turned up a new parks card, we were like, ooh, this park, whoa, you know, thinking about the park. Have we ever been to this park?
Yeah.
And so there was this kind of this meta commentary about the content of the game rather than the gameplay. We were still playing competitively. We had a fun time. We were still kind of monitoring each other's progress towards the game goal. But then when we got to the end, like the actual results of our play session, we had like really close scoring. I was like, 15 points, 16 points, 17 points or something like that. Mm. And that was really fun. So we did care about the outcome of the game, but there was a lot more going on in our enjoyment of the experience of playing.
Yeah. Sure. That I think tracks a lot with what I've been describing.
Yeah.
Whereas like your motivations are not, they're not at cross purposes or on a detour from what the game is asking you to do. They're just like, they just sort of sidecar to it in a sense. Like you still progressed through the game and cared about everything it was, but you got this different enjoyment out of focusing on a different part of the experience.
Yeah.
Right. Caring more about the sort of, frankly, the lore in this game. Right.
Yeah.
And like the sort of narrative almost, I mean, now I'm imposing a story on this, but like imagining you're traveling to these parks as they reveal, right? Mm-hmm. Like, and then thinking about your own personal memories or knowledge of those places, the game's not demanding you do that, but it made you enjoy the game a little bit more.
Yeah. It's interesting. Like, we talk about racing at the Olympics and everyone's really interested in like who comes in first.
Yeah.
But of the hundreds of thousands or millions of people who run like a road race every year, most of those people are not going to win the race, and they're not even running because they think they can win the race.
Right.
So why are they racing? And maybe trying to answer that kind of question will lead you into that design space.
Oh, that's interesting.
That's cool.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like that.
Well, it's like, what is the phrase in baseball? Like, for the love of the game. Right.
Yeah. Like,
you know? Like, it doesn't mean, you know, that you don't love winning.
Yeah. Right.
Right?
Yeah.
And that you're not going to engage fully in the pursuit of the goal in front of you.
Okay.
It's just that's not why you're playing.
That's fascinating, because now I sort of get it more now, too, because I'm thinking of it with respect to fighting games, because of course I am.
Of course.
I like the idea of spirit of competition, in that we're each trying to strive to be better. Like, as a community, as a group.
Yeah.
That's the ideal. I don't think that always is the case. I feel like it's closest in terms of competitive video games. I feel like it's closest to, in fighting games than to, like, esports. But I'm biased. But I really like that idea that, like, I fought this person in a tournament and I beat him really hard, really heavily. And I played it a lot. Mm-hmm. And then they were like, oh, I really got to learn this matchup. I really want to get better at this game, and then get better. And then they come back to the tournament and then they fight me and then they beat me. Then I'm like, oh, dang, I lost to this person. I was doing so well last time. I got to get better. You know, like that. That is a kind of, that's a kind of motivation that I think is a cool driving factor in these kinds of games. Mm-hmm. Maybe is kind of a little opposing to what you like.
Yeah, Mark, no. But, I mean, that's not a hero there. Yeah, okay. I guess the thing that gets me with that is kind of the point of those games.
There's not always.
Really?
I mean, I'd like to think it is the point. I don't know that it always is the case that it is the point.
Okay.
I think that's fair. But I think that that's also how I've expressed that video game or fighting games.
I just can't imagine myself joining a fighting game community and treating it in any other way than that.
Well, there's a bunch of, I mean, there's, I don't want to get into the weeds on it, but there's other ways to approach fighting games. Like, you can be a labber where you just like learn a bunch of combos and stuff.
Sure.
And teach those to people and people learn those and get
better. Right. Those who can't do coach. Right?
Yeah. I mean, coaching literally is a thing too. You can do.
Yeah.
Those kinds of aspects of it. Yeah. And this, and then there's like, you know, professionals, and they get paid to do it.
Mm-hmm.
Well paid. They compete. In order to make money, so like they're playing not to get better. They're not playing for the betterment of the community. They're playing because they want to win, because that's how they make a living,
right?
Yeah.
And that's a different entirely.
It's just like professional racers,
right?
You know, they do absolutely do benefit from there being a community of people who are interested in running.
Yes, because there's more people for them to beat.
Right, because then those people are the ones who buy the shoes that are from the companies that sponsor the big race prizes.
Right. Yeah.
Again, subsidized by an unseen class of losers.
Yes. Uh-huh. It's full circle again.
But I think, Stephen, I think what you illustrate is that even with games that essentially are pretty much played one way, to be uncharitable, you can still find these things.
Yes.
Huh. Right? So I think that actually really illustrates the point very well, is that it's not something that no game can do.
Right.
Or that any game can't do, right?
Yes. Yeah. Hmm. Cool. This is really interesting. Mm-hmm. A direction in game design that I hadn't even considered.
Yeah, well, I want to come back to this.
Yeah, we've been working on Robostin, and it's something that, you know, you design new missions that do sort of feel like it's reusing the same vocabulary. And so it got me thinking a lot about, like, trying to find a way to define it a little better so that it I can't explain it when people are like, why do you think the games are similar? And I'll explain that if it's not obvious. Exactly. So yeah. I just want to work more on Robossin, I guess.
That's our show. For show notes and links on today's topics, go to our website, nicegames.club. Visit us on Threads at Nice Games Club, where Dale posts about game dev resources and Sony Trinitron SSM 9040p pairings. I put this thing in here and I regret it. reply there on Threads or email us contact at nicegames.club. Nice Games Club is on Patreon. Support the show and get stuff, including ad-free episodes. Sign up at patreon.com/nicegamesclub. And if you want to keep things more casual, just stop by nicegames.club/discord and say hello.
So, until we start again, remember to
play nice
and make nice.
You can if you're
whoever's editing.
Okay.
Snip out this part and add the reverb effect.